Live from New York City, it's The Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. Today, we're going to look at how to have a healthier heart and a healthier gut. And we're also going to have a guest in the second part of our program. In fact, I'm going to give that guest more time than normal because she's in Iran or just returned. She has a lot to share about the country and its culture and history. And in preparation for today's program, I not only reviewed the history under the Shah, who was our puppet and ally, and what happened then, but what happened under Meshedek, who was the democratically elected prime minister, who wanted to nationalize the oil, British Petroleum oil. And then basics. What is their culture like? What's it like to live in Iran today? We know it's a theocracy, but it also has a government. How much rights, freedoms do people have or not? So I spend hours reviewing history of it. So it'll be interesting to see if what I've read and watched aligns with Medea Benjamin. Medea Benjamin founded Code Pink, a feminist anti-war movement group that does a lot of good. She'll be the guest. We'll also have a few short clips to share with you, some audio clips, and including a 70-second clip about seven truths about immigration. Then how our government wastes our money with no accountability and no one ever held responsible for our money. And then how the United States actually threatened Ecuador over breastfeeding. We're opposed to it as official policy, and they are not. Sounds stupid, is stupid, but we want to review it because that's what's coming out of the Senate White House. If you haven't written these two numbers down, please do, because the one number is where you can listen to this program over any listening device, from a hardline telephone, a cell phone, a computer, a laptop, every day, Monday to Friday, noon to 1 Eastern Standard Time, 424-203-8046. That's 424-203-8046. But about 90% of the people who listen download over the archives in the evening. So here's that number, 701-719-9976. 701-719-9976. We always begin with the latest on health and healing, and this is from San Francisco State University. They want to take a look at our gut microbiome, which is the bacteria in our gut, and if it's related to cardiovascular fitness. Well, it turns out that exercise can do more than slim down your waistline and boost your heart health. It might also make what's inside your gut healthier. That's right. In its first of its kind study, just published in the International Journal of Sports Nutrition and Exercise Metabolism, they found that when you're exercising, there's a relationship going on every second between your gut and your heart. That's very important. And it means that a good exercise, good heart, good food, good bacteria, exercise and eat good food, good bacteria, and good heart. So if you want the best cardiovascular fitness and you want the best bacteria, then just do the two together. Eat healthy and exercise. It's that simple, not complicated. Now, my family came from two places. One was from the border between Germany and France, the Huguenots. They came as Quakers. That's my background. And they were mainly farmers. In fact, they settled what is now the entire Shenandoah Valley. And they also became engineers. And they were quiet, peaceful people. close to the earth, which is, I guess, part of the reason I've spent my entire adult life living on either a farm or a ranch and having animals that I rescue and teaching gardening and organics. It's in my genes. It's part of just who I am, being close to the earth. Where other people, they don't care if they ever put their hands in the soil. They like the city and the suburbs. And then they went from North Carolina to Kentucky and Virginia, and that's where they resided. So you come from the South. The South is what's below the Mason-Dixon line. The Mason-Dixon line runs through West Virginia. But there's a culture that manifests on many different levels. For example, the diet. Now, historically, the Southern diet was prized because of its rich spiciness versus in the New England where they lack those spices. They were very puritanical up there. And part of having that Spartan Puritan mindset was austerity of taste, meaning whatever something tasted, that's it. You didn't enhance it in any way. So people were used to having New England pot dinners. Now, there were variations of that. As people evolved, they wanted to use different spices, but it was very common for everything up north to be boiled. And if you were close to the ocean, then you had whatever's in the ocean. If not, then you mainly had starches, like potatoes or corn, which was a staple. Over the years, the Southern diet de-evolved. There was a time when you ate a lot of greens, mustard greens and parsnips, turnips, beets and beet greens, carrots, rutabaga, and not anymore. What has happened now is the Southern diet is one, if you watch any of these television shows, very spicy, loaded with animal proteins, pork or beef, and deep fried, and or if it's barbecued, it's frequently barbecued for over 13 hours. And they even have contests, and you would be amazed how many people show up at these state fairs and go to these contests where the most sickening food you've ever seen in your life, they just gobble it down. Anyhow, you develop an acquired taste for this. Now, if you're eating this from childhood on, then that's going to be what you crave, what you want. But it's bad to the bone. In fact, of all the areas in America where I counsel people coming from Louisiana, Mississippi, Alabama, Georgia. Don't consider Florida part of the South, even though it is located in the South. It doesn't have the Southern culture. Georgia is where that ends, and Virginia is where it ends. You got South Carolina, North Carolina, Kentucky, and Tennessee are also in there, and half of West Virginia. Terrible diets. Here's the latest, University of Alabama, published in the Journal of the American Heart Association. They're saying that the Southern diet is deadly for people with heart disease. So let me just give you the short end of this. People with a history of heart disease who eat a traditional Southern diet are far more likely to die than those following, let's say, a Mediterranean diet that I talk about on this program, or certainly a vegan diet. Now, in fact, the Mediterranean diet is actually healthier than most Americans' vegan diets, and you have to parse this into two. One is the person who is on a vegan diet because they protest, and rightly so, the factory farming of animals and also how that influences nitrogen in the soil, and how that also depletes the ozone layer with high levels of methane and pollutes our water. All these things they take into account, but to varying degrees. But they're not looking at the diet because it's scrumptious and variable in its taste. It's a political statement, and that's a lot of young people. So technically speaking, a young person eating vegan pizzas all day and potato chips and pretzels would call themselves, an ethical vegan. Doesn't mean they're healthy. Whereas if you are one of the people, for example, there's one vegan restaurant in New York that I've tried to eat in. I just can't. The food is, from my, it's just terrible. And they have all this seitan, which is a protein coming from wheat. So if you don't eat wheat and you don't want gluten, why would you want seitan? But they use it as a meat alternative. So a lot of the people eating in these restaurants, you never see them talk about the food because they're on their cell phone or they're talking nonstop. The service is not excellent. The food is not. The prices are relatively inexpensive. The ambiance is virtually bare-bone aesthetic. And then you have some vegan restaurants that take a step up. Now, the best you can do fails miserably compared to the best that you get with a Mediterranean diet. Let me give you an example. My brothers and myself and a couple friends are driving the length of Italy. Yeah, we've hit some of the main cities because who wouldn't want to go to the Florence Museum and see Michelangelo's Statue of David and all the other great works and the cathedrals? It's just magical to be in Italy. The Italian people are wonderful as well. But we wanted to hit the side roads. We wanted to go to the small villages, places that were off the map, so it wouldn't be touristy. So you'd be able to meet people who weren't trying to sell you something. This is just typical what I'm going to share with you now. This is not exceptional. Down the coast, not far from Naples, there is a driving down and you get beautiful sights of the Mediterranean. But it's August, it's very warm, but it's not a humid warm. And there is a small restaurant with a small village. Pull up, Gwen. Only has had about 8 tables, so it doesn't seat very many people. There's an older woman who comes over. She not only takes your order, but then she goes and prepares it. So I asked my friends who are from Italy and fluent, could you ask her, could I just sit quietly and watch what she does? Tell her I'm a chef in the United States, and I would appreciate this opportunity to see how she prepares the meal. Fine. If the kitchen alone, I'm told, the little restaurant made out of stone, is about 500 years old. And her family's lived there for longer than that. And that's not unusual. I visited a family's home that was 800 years old. And the same lineage, generation after generation, had lived there. So one of the things she does is she's talking, and my friend's translating, about what do I want? And because my friends and family are not strict with their diet as I am, and I told her that I was vegan and I like fresh, and she said, well, we only have fresh. And she's look around, do you see any cans? Nope. But she had all these jars, and in every jar there were different things that she had fermented, like different types of olives, but I mean a lot, a huge variety of olives, and far stronger than any olives I've ever tasted where I bought them at a farmer's market or any place else. And again, they had olive trees, and they grew their own olives, and they processed them. Olive oils that were, she had like 7 different types of olive oil, and one olive oil was an olive oil and balsamic vinegar combination, and they made their own balsamic vinegar, and they made their own olive oil, pressed it themselves, which is kind of neat to watch this process. In fact, I was so motivated when I came back, I bought some olive trees and planted them, and takes a while before they produce olives, but an olive tree can live 1,000 years. And how they get the olives off the tree used to, and by putting blankets around the bottom or sheets, and then shaking the tree, and the olives drop off. Now they do it with a machine, a strange-looking machine. It looks like a fan that encircles the trunk of the tree with a motor, and it vibrates it, and all the olives fall into the tray, and then they put it into barrels. In any case, she had sun-dried tomatoes, but like 6 different types, And I mean, there was a large variety of everything and different types of seasonings. Must have had at least 30 different trays of fresh herbs, whole giant trays, where she would use the fresh herbs. And then out back, there was a garden where she had all these different types of lettuces growing. And she'd go out and she would just break off the lettuce and put it in a bowl. And she came back in, she said, "This is enough." And I said, "No, I eat a lot more than that." So she went back and she got more and brought it back in. And she was laughing because normally they don't eat huge salads, relatively small salad. And everything's on a plate by itself. You don't get everything in a bowl. You don't get everything stacked on a plate. It's one course at a time where nothing is rushed. And there was some quiet, very soft music playing in the background, a guitar. So anyhow, I'm learning so many different ways, making all their fresh pastas and how they use stone grinding. So they get a really coarse but healthy pasta flour. And how they fill it, you know, with a marinated eggplant, and did all this right there, right in front of me. And it took about an hour to make the lunch, but my brothers wanted stuff from the ocean, or from the sea, and one of her relatives provides the fish. They go out early in the morning, like at 3 o'clock, bring in their nets. And they have a relatively small boat. And whether it's octopus or some other fish, it's all brought in. They put it in ice. And then people can select off a little board, the fresh fish of the day or the fresh soup of the day. And she made this wonderful lemonade with mint in it, mint leaves. And I said, "I don't eat sugar." She's all, "No problem, we have this whole thing of honey." She had a whole barrel of honey. So when you sit at a table and you're fed so many variety of foods in small plates, nothing big, like it would be like, oh, a cup of beans, a cup of soup, but you might have 10 of those, 10 different things, like the antipasta, and you fill up. In fact, there were more things offered than I could eat. But I saw how fresh it was, the variety, the time, the love that was put into it. And she just smiled. Just a wonderful human being who knew the purpose of her life and bringing some joy and happiness and great taste to other people. Now when we went back into Rome or Venice, and went to their restaurants, and I wanted to go to a typical restaurant, then I wanted to go to the best restaurant. I wanted to see what was the difference. And there's the interesting part is the average tourist goes to the typical restaurant, so they pretty much all have the same type of pastas and sauces. It's rather standardized. But you go to the gourmet restaurants, everything is custom done, and everything is fresh. And they pride themselves, the chief chef or the manager or the owner, going to the market each day and selecting everything that moment. Just like in New York, I filmed David Boulay, America's greatest chef. Those who know great dining know David and the uniqueness of his capacity to make a dish dance, and that's what he does. But I was there when he went to the farmer's market, and there was a stall that you would normally not pay attention to because it just looked like some overgrown weeds from the outside. No special decoration. But inside were over 120 different herbs. So he would go in, he'd break off a leaf and he would smell, he'd say, "Smell this, Gary," and he'd try it. And then he'd order, you know, two pallets of this, or not pallets, but two large containers of this. And that's what he had that day. And he does this every day. And gets his herbs, and then he had things growing also. Now he's growing a whole, in his new restaurant, which is, I don't believe it's going to be open for another year, he has a whole wall. It's a wall of food that microgreens and sprouts and lettuces, etc., tomatoes, that's what people will get that goes into their dishes. Really a fun concept. And I'll go down and try out his place when it opens. In any case, the gourmet restaurants were not expensive, and the meals were spectacular, and no one rushed anything. And that was the main meal of the day. Then they had a smaller meal in the evening, generally later in the evening. And then the whole country closes down for like 3 hours because they've had their meal, time to rest, and everything will come back up again later. Now that is the Mediterranean cuisine. I found that in Spain. I found that in France. You'll find it in Portugal. I did not find that in Germany. And I've never found a good place to eat in England, in Ireland or Scotland, though I'm sure it exists. I haven't gotten there. On my 40 different trips over there, I've tried just about everything. But you don't go to England because you want a phenomenal meal. You go for other phenomenal reasons. But the food, if you ever have a chance or put it on your list, go and spend a week enjoying the great cuisines throughout the country. And sometimes it's the smallest of villages in what you would consider, not an extravagant meal, very humble meal, but it's spectacular. Beats anything I've ever seen in the United States. So that's the difference between helping your heart with a southern diet where you actually kill yourself. The highest degree of heart disease, obesity, diabetes is in your southern states. Louisiana is top of the list. Then Alabama, West Virginia. The top five. I think you also have Mississippi. And don't confuse New Orleans cuisine with Louisiana cuisine, because what's in New Orleans, a lot of it's very healthy and very spicy and very tasty. A lot of it's not. You have to take it restaurant by restaurant. But if you've never been to New Orleans, wonderful people, the French Quarter, spectacular. I've been to, I guess, New Orleans, I don't know, 20 times. But I always love to run up the Mississippi in the morning because you can see these paddle ships going up the Mississippi, and then you see where the Mississippi opens up into the Gulf of Mexico. And then it's quiet, everyone's asleep. And then I start at the top, the last street up in the French Quarter, and I run from one end, come down the other block, like lacing a shoe, up and down every street till I have every single street down to Canal Street, then go back to whatever hotel I'm staying in, just to appreciate what's been there for hundreds of years. Another great place to visit in America if you haven't done it. In any case, here's what we learned. All those sugar-sweetened beverages, all that fried food and the processed meats, those saturated fats, that kills you. And this study shows it. But go on a Mediterranean diet and your heart's going to be really happy you did. In fact, a University of East Anglia, which is in the United Kingdom, did a study, and they found that eating a Mediterranean-type diet could reduce bone loss in people with osteoporosis. In fact, the findings published today show that sticking to a diet rich in fruits and vegetables and nuts and unrefined cereals and olive oil can reduce hip bone loss within just 12 months. That's terrific. So one more reason to switch over to a Mediterranean or plant-based diet. Not the easiest thing when we consider how addicted we are to a specific taste. And from the Environmental Working Group, just your regular conventional apple is drenched with a toxic chemical to keep them looking fresh. One reason to get organic apples. Because the non-organic apples hold a lot of pesticides. In fact, they had 4 different detectable pesticides in high concentrations. So keep that in mind, because you don't need these pesticides in your body. And also, the top diabetes treatments don't work in kids and teens, according to Yale University. So taking insulin, or the most commonly used drug for type 2 diabetes, metformin, failed to either delay or effectively treat the condition in youth, according to the new study. And the study is called the Restoring Insulin Secretion Pediatric Medication Study. And that's what they found. Once again, medicine goes off, spends years having people do something, and then finds out it doesn't work. And from Rush University Medical Center, they found that high blood pressure is linked to brain disease, like Alzheimer's. So keep your blood pressure down to normal and help prevent inflammation in the brain. This according to the journal Neurology, Journal of the American Academy of Neurology. I'm Gary Noll. That's the latest on health and healing. We're 26 minutes into our program, and we're going to take a break. And when we come back from the break, we're going to go directly to the U.S. threatening Ecuador over breastfeeding.
Or has ever been a baby. You see, at a meeting of the World Health Assembly back in May, U.S. delegates opposed an international resolution that supported breastfeeding. Of course, this is the Trump administration, so I assume they want to replace the word breast with something more tasteful like fun bags. The proposal encouraged WHO nations to protect, promote, and support breastfeeding, but American officials sought to water down the resolution. Important warning, never water down your breast milk resolution. It could lead to weight loss and lowered immunity. That's part joke, part real tip. The resolution was going to be introduced. Yeah. We aim to educate. The resolution was going to be introduced by Ecuador, but they dropped their support after the U.S. threatened to unleash punishing trade measures and withdraw crucial military aid over a breastfeeding resolution. That's like saying, I'll have a Coke. What's that? You only serve Pepsi? Okay, then I will burn down this Fuddruckers. But I will. I will. Mothers breastfeeding their babies should be a slam dunk. The resolution was just trying to limit the misleading marketing of breast milk substitutes. And there's been a lot of misleading marketings. I mean, just look at this Similac baby formula ad promising to burn belly fat and increase libido. The baby is jacked. But I gotta try some Similac.
Similacin.
But instead, the United States delegation is embracing the interests of infant formula manufacturers. Okay, look, for the record, I have no problem with formula. For some families, that could be the best option. But if you don't want your product to sound sinister, maybe don't call it the formula. What's that? What's that? What's that, darling? You see, our sweet little baby is hungry. Give her the formula. Then put her down for a nap in the laboratory. If she's still fussy afterwards, we'll hear it on the monitor and calm her down with more formula.
Okay, but this is actually real. They actually did this. Well, this is at a time when they have aligned themselves with formula manufacturers, just like the EPA aligned themselves with fossil fuel polluters, and now are denigrating the healthiest thing that a mother can do for the baby is breastfeed, for her immune system, for bone strength, for brain development, for natural creation of antibiotics bodies, because every time a mother kisses the baby, she is picking up the saliva of the baby, and in the mother's own body is creating antibodies that she then puts back through the milk. So every time that the baby is suckling, she is getting, or he is getting, natural antibody that is strengthening and developing the natural immune system. And yet Trump and the morons in that administration are saying, don't you dare suggest something as like breastfeeding. Just stupid to the bone. How do you deal with that kind of stupid? Realize that there's 104 million of us independents and progressives. We need to form multiple parties and hit on these issues to get these clowns out of office. Now let's hear in 70 seconds seven truths about immigration that you won't hear in the mainstream media.
Here are seven truths about immigration in under 70 seconds. Number one, a record high of 75% of Americans now say immigration is a good thing for the country. Number two, America needs more immigrants, not fewer, because our population is rapidly aging. Number three, historically, new immigrants have contributed more to society in taxes than they've taken from society in terms of public assistance. Number four, most immigrants don't take jobs away from native-born Americans. To the contrary, their spending creates more jobs. Number five, Trump's claim that undocumented immigrants generate more crime is dead wrong. Both legal and undocumented immigrants are significantly less likely to commit crimes than people born in the United States. Number six, violent crime rates in America are actually at historic lows, with the homicide rate back to its level from the early 1960s. Number seven, illegal border crossings have been declining since 2014, long before Trump's crackdown. There's no surge in illegal immigration. Please spread the truth.
Okay, we're going to go to Media Benjamin in just a few minutes, but I wanted to give you one example of what happens when a government agency that should have a meeting in any of the building, government buildings in Washington, D.C., that cost us nothing, decides to hold that meeting in Las Vegas, costing hundreds of thousands of dollars that we pay for. Why? And this is just one example of hundreds of thousands of examples that occur where our money, instead of being used to help we the people, to help all the different needs that we have, from universal health care to de-ghettoizing America, instead is used by these bureaucrats, and no one's held accountable. So one legislator looked into this, saw what they did in just one single example, and he's going to share just a few minutes of that to show you what's going on that we never hear about.
Frustration with government. They are absolutely convinced that we spend their money differently from the way that we would spend our own. And they are exactly correct. The rest of America cannot comprehend of a $44 breakfast. They are pouring generic brand cereal while you are eating a $44 breakfast. The rest of America would never conceive of a $7 Monte Cristo mini sandwich. And neither would you if you were spending your own money. You don't go out of your pocket and buy commemorative coins. I don't know anyone who does that. But we don't hesitate to spend taxpayer money on a trinket like that. Giving bicycles to indigent children is a wonderful idea. I hate that you robbed yourself of the satisfaction of knowing what it feels like to do it yourself instead of spending someone else's money to do it. The ostensible purpose of this hearing was to exchange ideas. You know, Alexander Graham Bell has this marvelous invention called a telephone. Or better yet, video conferencing. The notion that you have to spend $800,000 to exchange ideas is laughable and perhaps criminal. And the part that galls me the most is the hypocrisy of GSA not even following its own damn rules. You are so quick to make everyone else follow the rules, and you can't follow your own rules. You have an event planner on staff. That'll come as quite a surprise to most taxpayers. What will come as even more of a surprise is the fact that you didn't even use them. You paid somebody else to plan the event, despite the fact that you have event planners at taxpayer salary. And the scouting trips. You know, Mr. Chairman, the tribes of Israel sent 12 scouts into the Promised Land before they decided to invade, and GSA has to send 15 to Las Vegas to check out a hotel. Do you not see the outrage in that, Mr. Robertson? Do you see it?
Absolutely. This conference was outrageous.
Well, I'm not going to be as self-congratulatory as some other people are. I think the fact that we're having a hearing is a loss. Most people don't need a hearing to know that you don't spend other people's money the way that money was spent at this conference. We don't need a list of recommendations from the Inspector General. We don't need to be reminded that you can't negotiate a discount on a purse because the U.S. government decided to contract with a hotel. That is criminal. And a mind reader? My guess is they will not need a mind reader to find out the American public has lost confidence in the institutions of government and the response.
Could you imagine? Now, just think what he said. They could have done a conference call. They could have done a video conferencing at no cost. They had an event planner in their agency, and yet they spent money, $800,000, including sending 15 separate people out to inspect the hotel in Las Vegas. These are the games they play with our money, and that's simply, in my opinion, unacceptable. In just a few minutes, we're going to go to our guests. I was just told that we have back in stock as of today Supreme Health Formula. I've produced more of it this time. Normally, I only produce like 1,000 jars because I like everything super fresh. No one else does this. They produce a year, 2 years worth of. I produce like a month's supply. The trouble is we move manufacturers, and when we move manufacturers, they had a delay. So we've been out of it for about almost 4 months. So we have it back. Now, why would you be interested in Supreme Health Formula? Why? Well, first off, because I formulated it to make it the most all-inclusive, comprehensive, multiple vitamin nutrient formula in the world. First off, is I start with vegetarian ingredients and vegetarian capsules. There's a lot in here. And your vitamin A at 10,000 with beta-carotene and buffered vitamin C at 500 milligrams in each one. And vitamin D, 1,000 units. And vitamin E from natural forms, 200 units. And B1 and B2 and B6 at 25 milligrams each. And B12 at 500 micrograms. I mean, you're not getting that in others because I'm concerned about what those are going to do in a good way against some blood inflammatory factors. Also, calcium and magnesium, each 500 milligrams from citrate and manganese and chromium and molybdenum and selenium and pantothenic acid and folic acid, 800 micrograms of folic acid and biotin. And then the superstars. Yeah, I've got vitamin K and iron and zinc and boron and iodine and copper and potassium and permanganate and benzoic acid. But then you've got coenzyme Q10, quercetin, pycnogenol, ginkgo biloba, green tea, glutathione, phosphatidylserine, lutein, citrus bioflavonoids, inositol, cysteine, choline, bitartrate, inositol, bromelain, melatonin, and acetyl-L-carnitine. Yep, this makes it the best that I know of anywhere. Multiple vitamin nutrients, all in one. There it is. It's that simple. So if you want the best, the most comprehensive, the most synergistic, all in one, and easy to take because these are vegan capsules, they're on sale. Now, normally, originally this was $139. With this, it's $74.99. That's all cost you. Call 877-627-5065. 877-627-5065. 877-627-5065 for the Supreme Health Multiple Vitamin. It's now back in stock. And I placed an order, a huge order today, of a 9-month supply of all the different products I create so we won't be out. We've got a new manufacturer, so we're pleased about that. Back in a moment with my guest. Please stay with us.
Today, I was happy as a lark, but now I go for walks, to the movies, maybe to the park. I have a seat on.
Let's now go to my guest and say hello to her. She is Medea Benjamin, and I gave the bio on her earlier in the program. Nice to have you with us today, Medea.
Hey, Gary. Nice to be on the show.
After reviewing your work, one take-home message I found is that Iran is perhaps one of the most complex governments and societies on the planet, and at the same time full of contradictions between its theocratic body, ruled by its supreme leader, now held by the Ayatollah Khamenei, and its secondary parliament, democratic structure, with its elected president, Hassan Rouhani. And I'd like you to share with what life in Iran is like today, the role of women, the level of education, work, and equality. But first, I feel some history is important from the end of the U.S.-supported puppet and dictator, the Shah, Reza, and then to the 1979 revolution when Ayatollah Khomeini came to power and created an Islamic state based upon the Shia interpretation of the Quranic law and the Sharia. So please start the revolutionary period with an emphasis on the relationships between Iran, the United States, and its allies before and after this transition of power. And in what ways did this set the stage for the animosities that still exist today between Iran, the United States, and Israel? The floor is yours.
Thank you. Well, it is a complex society, and when you talk about the time of the Shah in the 1900s, this was a pro-Western leader who was very repressive internally, but he was a favorite of the West because he did things like give away the keys to the treasure chest, and the main treasure is oil. So the fact that he gave concessions to the British company that is today BP was something that many Iranians didn't like. And they thought, well, the oil should enrich us and not the British. And they did what people do when they organize nonviolently, which is they elected a prime minister in 1951 on a platform to say, let's take back our oil. And that was Mohammad Mossadegh, and he proceeded to do precisely that. Well, turned out the British were horrified. They went to the U.S. for help, got the CIA involved, and overthrew the democratically elected government in 1953. Now, some of your listeners might think, well, this is ancient history. It's not. It is absolutely critical to what Iran is today and the problems in U.S.-Iranian relations today. Because what happened after 1953? Well, Iranians were exiled, they were killed, they were imprisoned, the Shah cracked down on dissent, and the only place where people could organize were the mosques. And so the mosques became stronger and stronger, and when in 1979 the Iranians were able to overthrow the Shah, there were many people who wanted to create a secular government, but they didn't have the power or the organizing skills. And so the clerics were the one that did, and that gave the power to the Islamic Revolution, which was formed in 1979. It was not just anti-Shah. It was also anti-American because precisely of the way the Americans had interfered historically.
Okay, then the last time you were on the program, we discussed Saudi Arabia. In what ways are Saudi Arabia and Iran similar, since both are primarily theocratic nations? And how do they differ, especially with respect to women's rights and the education and employment of women? And also, both resort to capital punishment, whippings, imprisonment, and execution with respect to anything that is considered heresy, or when a Muslim renounces the Islamic faith, or homosexuality, or drug use, or adultery. And which country is the more tolerant and provides a more individual freedom base? So take us through these, please.
Well, these two are tough questions. I will want to preface it by saying that both societies are societies that I would not like to live in. And I would think if I lived in them, I would probably be in jail for pushing for my rights. Given that, Saudi Arabia is way more repressive than Iran is. You have the, just take the issue of the employment of women. There are the majority of women in the university in Iran, they get jobs afterwards, whereas Saudi women have a hard time getting jobs. They're only maybe 20% of the employed, whereas they are well employed in Iran and in all aspects of society. The Saudi women are still struggling for the right to drive, which they just got on June 24th, but many don't still have the driver's license, the cars, and all the, this has inhibited their ability to work, whereas Iranians have been driving for ever and much more integrated gender-wise in the workplace. Saudi Arabia, you have tremendous gender segregation. Even if you go into a McDonald's or a Starbucks in Saudi Arabia, there's a side for women and families and a side for men. You don't have that kind of segregation in Iran. So Iran is much more liberal, much more, women have more rights in Iran. But there are still restrictions. And in general, you also asked about the use of the death penalty. Both make, unfortunately, use of the death penalty and corporal punishment and are known for torture in the prisons. The Iranians have been using the death penalty for nonviolent drug offenses, and have more recently, because of the pressure from the international community, promised to cut way down on that. We will see by the end of this year if that has been the case. In both societies, there is a Sharia law. There are both societies that are governed by Islamic law, even though one is Shia, one is Sunni. So in that sense, they both have restrictions and for people who are of other religions or not religious. There is much more overt religion in Saudi Arabia. The businesses have to close their doors when it's prayer time. You see people all over who will stop and pray. Whereas Iran, there is a much more secular or non-religious sector of the society. You don't have to close your business for prayer time. You don't see people praying in public. And one of the ways that people have rebelled against the society in Iran is to become less religious.
When you look at life each day in Iran today, you have people who live by the theocratic rules, and then you have highly educated younger people who are living a semi-Western type of life, but still restricted in the amount of freedoms they have, freedom of speech, freedom of what they can see on the internet. Tell us about what life is like for the average person. We're talking about over 80 million people. It's one of the more populous nations in the Middle East.
That's right. And I ask people all the time, either in Iran or in the United States, people who are from Iran and recently emigrated to the United States, what was your life like? And you get different responses. There are many women who have said to me, I'd never felt oppressed in Iran. I had a good education. I went to college. I studied for a PhD, or I went into business. I started my own business. The sanctions affected me because I couldn't get the materials I needed for the business, or I couldn't make the financial transactions. But the government never bothered me except that I have to wear a scarf. And there are others who say, I wanted more political freedoms, and when we felt like the vote was stolen from us in 2009, joined the Green Revolution, went out on the streets, and was oppressed by the government and felt the weight of the religious society and decided I wanted to leave. So you hear different things from different people. And in general, people have a pretty normal life. Their ideals, their goals, their aspirations are not all that different from those of people in this society. And it's only when they come into they start getting involved to create more freedoms. For example, women wanting to be able to go into the sports stadiums to watch the teams. That has not been legal until recently. And women who were pushing for having equal rights to men could find themselves being repressed by the government. Women are not allowed to run for president, and there are women who put their names in and say, I want to run for president. So it's really, if you're going to get involved to try to make the society more free, you come up against the hard line of the government that might crack down on you and make your life difficult.
The final question, because I want you to take a little more time on this, is that virtually all of the arguments against Iran is that they're building nuclear weapons or trying to, that Hezbollah is in Iran and is being sent into Israel and other countries, and it's a terrorist organization, and that we must do all we can to prevent them from making the bomb. Then there's the truth. Tell us what you know about this.
Well, Iran has no nuclear weapons. The deal that was negotiated after many years was considered a good one that would stop Iran from getting nuclear weapons for quite a long time, and was signed by the U.S., Iran, British, French, Germans, Russians, Chinese. It was approved by the European Union, by the U.N. Security Council unanimously. And the Atomic Energy Association that was charged with monitoring Iran's compliance consistently said that Iran was complying. So, unfortunately, Trump, that wasn't enough for Trump, and he pulled the U.S. out of that deal. But who did he listen to? He listened to Israel, that has always lied about its nuclear weapon program, that has several hundred nuclear weapons, but will not tell the world what they have, and certainly will not join the non-proliferation treaty like the Iranians did, and will not allow any inspectors into their facilities. And, of course, the United States have thousands of nuclear weapons. So you have to look at it and as from the point of view of the conservatives in Iran who say, why are we even negotiating with these countries that have nuclear weapons, or that when we make a deal with them, the next president comes in and goes back on that deal. And that is precisely what happened with Donald Trump, and unfortunately has given justification to the conservatives and has taken away a lot of the power from the more moderate government of President Rouhani.
I recently wanted to see what life was like for those who have money, and there's a series of videos, well-made videos, about the young affluent of Iran. And you would not have known that this was not Beverly Hills, private cars that are very expensive, Maseratis, Ferraris, Lamborghinis, private parties in people's homes, alcohol being served, jetting all over the world, private ski locations, going to clubs and restaurants that are off limits to the average Iranian, even if they had the money to go, they don't have the social position to go. And we're not talking about a few people or even a few thousand people. We're talking about hundreds of thousands of young people, including millennials, who are living like they were, you know, helicopter parents.
Well, I don't know how much that is still the case, because just in the last year, the value of the Iranian currency, the rial, has fallen by half, and it's really affected the lives of the people in Iran. Of course, it's affected more the poor and the middle class. The elite in Iran are oftentimes connected to the government, and that's one of the really negative effects of sanctions, Gary, because it's ironic that the U.S. places these very, very onerous sanctions on Iran to get at the government. But really what it does is make the Iranian civilians more dependent on the government. And it makes reinforces the more corrupt elements of the Iranian society, the ones who can find ways around the black market, who can profit from the lack of competition. And so you see more disparities, whereas I think if the sanctions were lifted, Iran would go back to having a much more thriving and large middle class.
Do you see any reason to believe that Iran should be labeled as one of the most dangerous countries in the world?
Well, certainly if you looked at Saudi Arabia and Iran and compared the damage that they're doing in the world, Saudi Arabia by far would be worse, whether it's the spreading of their perversion of Islam called Wahhabism, the most intolerant version around the world, and understanding that this Wahhabism has formed the ideological basis of terrorist groups from ISIS to Al-Qaeda. And let's remember, 15 of the 19 hijackers in the United States were Saudis, zero were from Iran. There's never been an Iranian that has been involved in a terrorist attack in the United States. And then you look at the largest catastrophe in the world right now in Yemen, and it is the Saudis who are responsible for the bombing campaign that is causing the greatest damage there. Yes, you can fault Iran for being involved in backing the Assad regime in Syria. And certainly, Iran has been supporting Shia militias in Iraq, who over the years have been involved in activities like ethnic cleansing of Sunni neighborhoods. But by comparison, the Saudis are far more extremist and far more responsible for the catastrophic conflicts in the Middle East.
I appreciate you coming on and sharing these insights. And your new book is Inside Iran, The Real History and Politics of the Islamic Republic of Iran. And the website is Code Pink for Peace. codepink.org. Thank you for being with us.
You don't need the four P's, Gary. It's just codepink.org. And thank you so much for having me on.
All right. Medea Benjamin, I'm Gary Nall. We're out of time. Thank you all for listening. We'll look forward to having more on our next program.